Welcome to the Confluence of Ideas from Confluence Investment Management. I'm Phil Adler. As the financial markets dealt with geopolitical volatility to begin the new year, the Confluence Asset Allocation Committee met, as it does every quarter, to consider changes in the investment mix for the firm's five model portfolios. As a reminder to our listeners, risk management is the fundamental guide for all five Confluence investment models. Those portfolios are income, income with growth, growth in income, growth, and aggressive growth. These portfolios are managed by a committee that includes professionals from across the firm. Our guest today to discuss how the firm has rebalanced its portfolios to match its first quarter outlook for the economy and the markets is the chair of the committee, Kajsa Stuckey. Kajsa, I was struck by the tone of your report this quarter. It seems calm and measured in contrast to some of the highly charged predictions and outlooks I've read elsewhere that have grown predictably out of the extraordinary geopolitical events we've experienced in the latest 3 months. You continue to see a low risk of recession over your three-year forecast period, and your portfolio recommendations this quarter seem a little bit like tweaks rather than dramatic changes. I'm wondering if you agree with this. I'm wondering if you agree with this, and if you do, whether you see this as a validation of your process.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me. And yes, I do agree with that framing. The tone is calm because our base case is calm. We continue to expect near-trend growth over our three-year forecast period, with recession risk low, but not zero. That outlook doesn't require dramatic portfolio swings from our prior quarter. It calls for disciplined risk management and incremental adjustments. And I do think it validates our process. We're not trying to predict headlines. We're trying to build portfolios that can compound through uncertainty. Even when geopolitics are loud, our job as a committee is to separate market noise from what we see as more durable economic drivers, the policy mix, inflation persistence, and market structure. And keep in mind that we are forecasting out on a three-year rolling timeframe each quarter. So this itself smooths the path of likely outcomes through time. So going back to your question, yes, measure changes are not a sign of complacency. They're a sign we're sticking to a repeatable framework and we're positioning for the most likely environment while staying prepared for the less likely ones.
You say that your base case is a steady policy-supported environment rather than a highly cyclical boom and bust outcome. Let's drill down a little bit on this. What do you mean?
Yeah. What I mean is we don't see the economy accelerating into an overheating boom, but we also don't see it collapsing into a recessionary bust. We see the expansion as durable, supported by an important combination of two factors: monetary policy becoming more supportive as growth cools, meaning the Fed leans more dovish, and also fiscal support, which is still present through tax advantages, ongoing spending, and investment initiatives. So the economy can stay on a steadier path, not spectacular, but stable. Now, a key nuance in that steady doesn't mean quiet. We actually expect higher volatility in both the data as well as the markets because of cross currents like the trade policy uncertainty, uneven labor conditions, as well as geopolitics. But volatility doesn't automatically equal recession. That same volatility also creates opportunity.
Well, your outlook for the U.S. labor market is for a gradual softening, but nothing alarming. Is the public focusing too much on the possibility of layoffs caused by the emergence of AI and a slowdown in consumer spending and ignoring some positive employment trends?
Yeah, I think sometimes the public conversation can become very binary. It's either, you know, everything is fine or we're headed into layoffs, but our view is more measured. We do expect softening, but it's likely to come through slower hiring, fewer job openings, and tighter control of headcount, not necessarily dramatic headline layoffs. And AI is part of that story, especially in certain white-collar functions. But the labor market is still uneven in a way that helps stabilize the picture. For example, healthcare and related services continue to show reliable employment growth, and leisure and hospitality has remained resilient. Now, at the same time, we do recognize pressures for newer entrants, especially recent college grads, where unemployment as well as underemployment have risen. So yes, the layoffs narrative can be overstated, but the softening is real. We just view it as gradual rather than abrupt.
Turning to inflation, your call for inflation to moderate from peak levels but still remain above the Federal Reserve official target of 2%, and for Fed policy to lean dovish. Are you concerned at all by reports that foreign governments may be starting to turn away from U.S. Treasuries and that this trend may drive up U.S. rates and inflation?
It's something we're watching because the rate environment is unlikely to return to the ultra-low levels of the prior decade. Our base case still calls for inflation to moderate from peak levels, but remain above the Fed's long-term target. So, you know, we've mentioned this 2.5% to 3.5% range. And in that environment, the Fed can still lean more dovish if labor softens. But importantly, structurally, there are reasons longer-term yields may stay elevated. And these reasons are, you know, fiscal-driven issuance of debt that you mentioned, tariff-related inflation risks, as well as a rebuild of term premium and potentially softer foreign demand for treasuries over time. So yes, those dynamics can put upward pressure on long rates.
Kaiser, you remain positive on U.S. equities this quarter, with some clear preferences within this category, which we'll get to in a moment. I'm struck, though, by reports I've seen showing foreign equities have been outperforming the U.S. lately, when you factor in the weakness of the U.S. dollar. In light of this, are you less positive about U.S. equities than you used to be?
You know, I describe it as more balanced, not necessarily less positive. And a lot of this has to do with market structure and investor demand. We remain constructive on U.S. large caps, and we recognize passive flows remain a structural tailwind, particularly supporting large caps more than smaller caps. Index flows are likely to continue supporting the domestic equity segments in the short to medium term. And a broadening of the rally allows for a longer tail for equity risk. But we also think the macro backdrop supports international diversification right now. If we get more scope for the U.S. dollar softness, that's a meaningful tailwind for international assets. And international developed equities can also offer a valuation advantage, the potential for fiscal support abroad, as well as the benefit of broader leadership if U.S. markets rotate. So we're not abandoning U.S. equities. We're saying the opportunity set is improving globally, and the case for international is strengthening. But this quarter, we increased exposure to both domestic large cap equities as well as international developed markets.
Well, where are the best opportunities within U.S. equities right now? What are you focusing on?
Yeah, that's a great question. We think the opportunity is in the broadening market leadership. Mega cap tech has dominated for a long time. Those valuations are elevated, and in an ongoing expansion, we often see improving breadth, what people call interest in the other 493. So within U.S. equities, we remain constructive on large caps, but also we emphasize dividend-oriented ETFs as a stabilizer in a higher volatility environment, as well as maintaining exposure to defense and security related technology themes. And this quarter, we added communication services to some of the portfolios. That sector can benefit from the same market structure dynamics that are supporting index leaders while still offering a differentiated sector exposure.
Let's look at the individual asset allocation models as we discuss some of the specific rebalancing adjustments you've made. You favor treasuries and mortgage-backed securities over corporate bonds in your income portfolios. With more U.S. companies issuing debt, why aren't corporate bonds more attractive?
The short answer is because spreads are still historically tight, and we don't think investors are being well compensated for the risk. Credit fundamentals are generally intact, but valuations matter. When spreads are tight, the potential upside is limited, and the downside increases if conditions deteriorate. So across strategies, we continue to emphasize U.S. Treasuries for stability and ballast, seasoned mortgage-backed securities for income and structure, and selective exposure to high-quality spec-grade bonds, where really in our models, that's limited to the higher-quality BB-rated bonds. And yes, we remain underweight corporate bonds because spreads don't look attractive relative to risk.
You have erased or reduced previous positions in mid-cap stocks in four of your five portfolios. Why?
You know, this is one of the more quietly important shifts this quarter. And the reason is market structure. Passive flows continue to disproportionately support large cap equities and index heavyweights. In other words, even if mid caps have good fundamentals, they don't benefit from the same structural bid that large caps do. And in a higher volatility environment, we want the equity exposure to be supported by liquidity and market structure. So you're right, we've reduced mid-cap exposure and lean more towards the large caps.
And tell us more about how big a role stock dividends play in your recommendations.
Dividends play a meaningful role, especially when we expect a higher volatility backdrop. Since dividend-paying equities can provide a more stable return component, a potential cushion during drawdowns, and a more balanced exposure when market leadership is rotating. So those are the reasons why we maintain dividend-oriented ETFs, not only in the more conservative strategies, but also as part of the broader equity overlay across allocations.
You maintain allocations to gold across all your strategies, suggesting gold prices may have more room to run. You've added, though, some exposure to global metals and mining companies. Is this a case of these companies catching up to the actual price of the metals?
That's a fair way to frame it, but as you can guess, there's more to this story. Gold remains a strategic anchor because it diversifies the portfolio and hedges elevated geopolitical risk. And we still think gold benefits from continued central bank buying and ongoing pressure on the U.S. dollar over time. So metals and mining companies are slightly different. They can participate in upside when demand strengthens for key industrial inputs. We added them because we expect mining companies can participate as demand strengthens. And in that sense, yes, it can be viewed as catching up dynamic relative to the underlying metal cycle.
And are global metals and mining companies a key component of your continued favorable outlook for international developed equities?
They're more of a complement than the entire thesis, but they fit well inside the international sleeve. Our bullishness on international developed equities come from a few core pillars. There's a valuation advantage. We're seeing fiscal support abroad and the likelihood of U.S. dollar softness improving relative returns from abroad. Metals and mining is an additional way to express global growth and real asset demand across regions, and it broadens the drivers of return inside that international sleeve.
I noticed some exposure to platinum in the more risk-tolerant portfolios. Why platinum?
Yeah, but platinum is a smaller position, and you're right. It's only in the two more risk-tolerant strategies. Platinum offers an interesting setup from a supply-demand perspective, and it has a valuation profile that still looks attractive relative to gold. So we view it as a diversifier, not replacing gold, but adding a differentiated precious metal.
Well, as we sum up, a couple of broad questions. First, is the rapidly deepening U.S. fiscal deficit a problem that could explode into runaway inflation and escalating interest rates anytime soon?
It's a long-term risk factor we take seriously. But our base case is not runaway inflation. What we expect is inflation that stays above target and a rate environment that remains structurally higher than the prior decade. Fiscal deficits matter because they influence issuance, term premiums, and confidence in the long-run stability. But anytime soon implies imminent runaway inflation, and that's not our outlook. Instead, we think markets will deal with a more persistent, messy inflation profile, and that supports our balanced approach across equities, high-quality fixed income, as well as gold.
Finally, a catastrophic geopolitical event could always surprise and upset the best laid investment guidelines. How do you bake such a possibility into your portfolio recommendations?
We treat geopolitics as an uncertainty we can't forecast precisely, but we can manage exposure to its consequences. That's where diversification and risk management matter most. So we're maintaining gold across strategies as a hedge and a stabilizer, as we talked about. We're holding treasuries and MBS for ballast and liquidity. We're avoiding overly concentrated equity outcomes and building portfolios that can remain durable even if volatility rises. I'll say our firm's CIO, Mark Keller, often says we are professional worriers. So yes, we're absolutely aware of these catastrophic risks, but we aim to construct our asset allocation portfolios such that they remain durable across a range of potential outcomes.
Thank you, Kaisa. If our listeners would like to read the detailed first quarter 2026 Asset Allocation Outlook report and see all the changes in viewer-friendly charts, that's easy to do. Just access confluenceinvestment.com. There you'll find a tab for the Asset Allocation Quarterly on the top right. Our discussion today is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. And this information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll. I'm Phil Adler.